Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. NATO meeting expresses concerns about Russia. NATO Secretary General says the alliance's increased forward presence in Eastern Europe sends a clear signal to any would-be aggressor. In Brussels, before a two-day NATO defense ministers meeting, this is Jan Stoltenberg referring to Russia.
I expect the defense ministers to agree to enhance our forward presence in the eastern part of our alliance. This will send a clear signal. NATO will respond as one to any aggression against any ally. We have already significantly enhanced our presence and readiness of our forces.
Since Russia's seizure of Crimea almost 2 years ago, the Western military alliance has been increasingly concerned that Moscow could rapidly invade Poland or the Baltic states. British Defense Secretary Michael Fallon repeated that concern on arrival Wednesday in Brussels.
NATO faces pressures now on the eastern, its eastern border and in the Mediterranean. And today we need to unite around a clear plan to deploy troops and ships to deter any aggression and the threats that we've seen. And we want to see faster deployment of those troops.
NATO defense ministers are also expected to discuss Turkey's request for NATO help to slow the influx of migrants into Europe. Meanwhile, Russia figures prominently in another part of the globe, of course. Their stepped-up aerial bombardment in Syria is expected to be a focal point for the United States and other members of the International Syria Support Group when it meets this week in Germany. The ISSG, which includes Russia and Iran, is meeting Thursday on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference. This is VOA News. Now, the United Nations Security Council is holding a private briefing today on the humanitarian situation in Russia because of those very Russian bombardments. The operation has sent tens of thousands of people fleeing the northern city toward the Turkish border and raised alarms with the United Nations and aid groups who fear a humanitarian disaster in the region. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Wednesday at least 500 people have been killed since the offensive began, including about 100 civilians. The director of the U.S. National Intelligence, James Clapper, told U.S. lawmakers yesterday that the United States faces an array of security threats this year.
In my 50-plus years in the intelligence business, I cannot recall a more diverse array of challenges and crises that we confront as we do today.
Speaking to the Senate Armed Services Committee, Mr. Clapper said the Islamic State, or ISIL, remains the preeminent terrorist threat in the world.
ISIL has demonstrated sophisticated attack tactics and tradecraft. ISIL, including its 8 established and several more emerging branches, has become the preeminent global terrorist threat. They have attempted or conducted scores of attacks outside of Syria and Iraq in the past 15 months. ISIL's estimated strength worldwide exceeds that of al-Qaeda.
The intelligence chief said the ISIS group is determined to strike the U.S. homeland beyond inspiring homegrown attacks. He also said other threats include cyber assaults from several countries, as well as the nuclear program of North Korea. Mr. Clapper said the North has restarted a plutonium reactor and is seeking advanced missile technology. Iraq says its forces have completely recaptured the city of Ramadi and surrounding areas from Islamic State. The IS group seized the provincial capital last May. Iraq's ambassador to the United States tells VOA Iraqi forces will now focus on retaking Mosul, lost to Islamic State in 2014. Zimbabwe has appealed for a $1.5 billion to help pay for grain and other food after a drought has devastated harvests and left millions in need. Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, his appeal follows President Robert Mugabe's declaration of a state of disaster. Meanwhile, the Save the Children charity warns food aid for millions of Ethiopians affected by drought will run out in April unless more funds are provided by month's end. And the South African opposition Tuesday asked the Constitutional Court, the country's highest, to rule on whether President Jacob Zuma broke the law by spending over $20 million on a state-funded security upgrade for his private home. Those upgrades included a swimming pool and an amphitheater. Last week, the president said he was prepared to repay some of the expenses. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
It was very clear the peace implementation is not being prioritized by the two sides. And we know that that is the answer to starting to address the humanitarian crisis that we see looming in South Sudan.
That's U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield commenting on the South Sudan conflict. Details coming up.
Also in Kenya, six elephants have died in 1 week under unclear circumstances. And a new UN report says female genital mutilation afflicts tens of millions of women and girls worldwide.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Gabon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, a UN refugee agency official says there is no evidence that Burundi security officials or political opposition recruiters are operating in refugee camps in the region. Burundi's government has charged that rebels are recruiting combatants in camps in Nduta, Tanzania, which is run by the UNHCR. However, the UNHCR representative for Tanzania told France's state-run radio there is no evidence of security officials or opposition recruiters conducting operations in these camps. Joyce Menz-Cole said UNHCR has done its best to maintain the civil nature of the camps.
High-ranking U.S. State Department official says the U.S. is encouraging both sides in the South Sudan conflict to work towards peace. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield says the issue of South Sudan's civil war was brought up at the recent AU meeting in Addis Ababa.
At the start, we were incredibly engaged with both sides when we were at the AU to push them, urge them, encourage them to make the right decisions in moving forward on the implementation of the peace agreement. Our special envoy for Sudan and South Sudan, Don Booth, is out in the region as we speak. We had intense meetings with President Mohai, who has been leading the efforts of the UN and others to push the parties back to the implementation table. We were very disappointed at the responses that we got. It was very clear that the peace implementation is not being prioritized by the two sides. And we know that that is the answer to starting to address the humanitarian crisis that we see looming in South Sudan. What we have said is that these leaders have to care about the impacts on of this war on their people. And we can't care more than they care. So this is high on our agenda. But in the meantime, what we're trying to do is address the humanitarian consequences through an intense program.
The Assistant Secretary of State also says the U.S. is working closely with the Nigerian government to control violence by Boko Haram in West Africa, especially on what she called capacity training.
We know that training is important, and training doesn't provide an immediate solution to the problem. But for the military and for the other government agencies to be effective, they have to be well trained. We need to do more. The Nigerian government needs to do more in working with the police, because it is not the military's job to provide the immediate security in villages once the military kicks Boko Haram out and people try to return to their villages. They need a security service in the form of well-trained policemen who know how to deal with this kind of security.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield added she believes Obama initiatives in Africa will continue under a new administration next year. She says all of the programs enjoy bipartisan support in the U.S. Congress. ¶¶
businesses are expected to face challenges in 2016 from terrorism, corruption, a precarious judiciary, and the upcoming general elections, according to global business risk consultancy Control Risks. The firm held its Kenya launch today to release the findings of its Risk Map 2016 report. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
The threat of terror attacks is one of the key risks of doing business in Kenya, according to Control Risks, a global consultancy firm that has released its 2016 report highlighting for private and public organizations what it considers some of the most significant trends in global risk. East Africa senior analyst Paul Gabriel says the perception of East Africa as being negatively impacted by terrorism affects the business community and the region's economy.
But there isn't necessarily always well understood differentiation between different parts of Kenya. So you might have a company operating in Nairobi and therefore being perhaps not so much exposed as a company operating along the Somali border, but an outside client, an outside customer might not necessarily understand that.
However, Gabriel emphasized that these current dynamics may change as terrorist groups alter their tactics.
Just because those groups don't operate in the big economic hubs in East Africa right now doesn't mean that their evolution will not lead to them becoming strong enough to regain that capability again.
Control Risks analysts say the politicization of the anti-graft narrative is increasing ahead of Kenya's 2017 elections, and so any enforcement of anti-graft laws will be, or will be perceived to be, politically skewed.
So we find that more and more politicians, more and more presidents are being elected on an anti-corruption campaign. At the same time, we see that those vested interests, the interests that exist in the political and the business environment, mean that actual progress in combating corruption is still very slow.
According to the report, global risks to doing business also include terrorism, as well as the Syrian crisis, cybercrime, and the future of the European Union. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And in Kenya, six elephants have died in 1 week under unclear circumstances. Some conservationists suspect the animals were poisoned. Mohammed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
The six elephants were found dead in three wildlife refuges in Narok County, southwest Kenya. The animals all died between February 1st and 6th. Kenya Wildlife Service spokesman Paul Gitau tells VOA that investigators are trying to establish the cause of the deaths.
Samples have been taken of all the six of them, because another male now was found on the 5th of February, and that was in Mara North Conservancy. Samples have been taken to Nakuru for analysis. They are analyzing. They don't seem to suspect any particular cause of it, so we are waiting for them to really give us the conclusion.
According to Gitau, the animals did not have any physical injuries. Some conservationists suspect the elephants may have been poisoned, and government officials have called on investigators to look into that possibility. Residents of Mara, a game reserve area that borders Tanzania, have complained in the past of wild animals destroying their crops and killing domestic animals. In December last year, three lions died of poisoning in the same area. Two people were arrested in connection with that incident. Gitau notes that at this time of the year, there is usually less conflict between the locals and animals.
The human wildlife conflict cases there in that particular area for around this period wasn't reported to be acute, so we don't think that there would have been that kind of reaction. But we are not quick to jump to any conclusion at the moment until we get those results.
Investigators are also looking at the local environment to see if the grass, crops and water the animals consume may have been toxic. The elephants also face threats from poachers who kill the animals for their ivory. But in these cases, the elephants' tusks were intact. For the moment, the deaths remain a mystery. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A new report says female genital mutilation and cutting of FGMC is a worldwide practice afflicting tens of millions of women and girls with greatly diminished sexual sensation and often lifelong emotional and psychological scars. The report says while FGMC is performed worldwide, the problem is most pervasive in Africa. In Sudan, Eritrea, Mali, Sierra Leone, Djibouti, and Guinea, for example, more than 80% of females between the ages of 15 and 45 have undergone the procedure often. often without anesthesia. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Arslana Suleiman, the U.S. State Department's acting liaison to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, a 57-member international body that has outlawed the practice. Suleiman began by pointing out that female circumcision, as it is sometimes called, is a cultural tradition, not a religious one.
Certainly, there's no mention of the practice in Islam or Christianity or in the text. Now, there are a lot of communities that happen to be Christian or Muslim who engage in the practice, but the origin of the practice doesn't have to do with the religion. It has to do with that community's traditional practices, because that usually predated the religion. The practice goes back for thousands of years, so it actually predates most of the religions that are practiced in Africa and the Middle East and Asia today. And in that respect, religious leaders have an important voice in clarifying that.
What exactly is female genital mutilation? What do they actually do to girls?
There's a range of practices, really. In a nutshell, female genital mutilation or cutting is the cutting or excision or mutilation of the female genitalia. They're usually cutting the clitoris area. Usually this practice occurs at a very young age. A lot of the stories that we hear happen to girls as young as 4 years old, where they don't really have knowledge of what's happening to them. A lot of people in the tradition, they talk about it as this is sort of a rite of passage for women or girls. But one of the other justifications that is sometimes used is that it can repress the female sexual drive, and that therefore will help them remain a virgin until they're married.
It also compromises their sexual pleasure and sensation, right?
Exactly, yes. Not only does this cause physical trauma to the women and girls who undergo it, but also it can lead to psychological problems later, and it can cause problems in marriages later, because it does reduce or even eliminate at times the sexual pleasure that people can have through intercourse. There is no justification for the practice. Unlike male circumcision, which does have health benefits according to the WHO and other leading international health organizations, female genital mutilation does not have any health benefits. In fact, it can lead to severe health complications and problems.
Now, how widespread is this practice?
It depends on the communities you're looking at. You know, in certain parts of West Africa, there is a high prevalence that can reach sometimes up to 90% in certain communities. And that's also the case in certain countries in East Africa. But it's not just an issue that's in Africa. It's also an issue that we see in the Middle East and Asia. And we also see it in immigrant communities, including in the West.
I noticed in the White House statement condemning this practice that somehow it was an empowerment issue. Can you kind of explain the connection between the empowerment of girls and women and refraining from this practice?
Well, you can say, you know, a female's control over her own body is really the ultimate example of one's independence, right? So if you are imposing a practice on someone at an age where they can't really consent, and in a way that can really have a psychological effect on that person's sense of independence or control over their own body, it certainly does get to issues of empowerment. And so one of the key aspects of some of the campaigns that focus on ending FGM is to increase the education and awareness at young ages. It certainly is a difficult battle, but that's one of the interesting things about the practice is that oftentimes, men in the community have no idea about the practice, or that people in the community, whether it's someone's aunt or a grandmother, may have a plan to do that to their daughter. So oftentimes, fathers have been allies in this battle to really be advocates for the girls and women. But you also often need the legal element so that there are some oversight by government involved and some potential sanctions involved, because there are individuals who sometimes have a monetary incentive within the practice itself. But I think this is also part of a building new traditions as well.
That was Arsalan Suleiman, the U.S. State Department's acting special envoy to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Suleiman spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
A
I'm Yehisu Heap, 20 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A high-ranking U.S. State Department official says the U.S. is encouraging both sides in the South Sudan conflict to work towards peace. A new U.N. report says female genital mutilation afflicts tens of millions of women and girls worldwide. And in Kenya, six elephants have died in 1 week under unclear circumstances. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A new Afrobarometer survey shows a decline in support for democracy in South Africa amid growing discontent in how it's being implemented. Multiracial democracy began in 1994, but despite promise and hope, the country in recent years has faced political turmoil, high unemployment, corruption scandals, and a lack of basic services. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Afrobarometer conducted its survey of South Africans between August and September of last year. Sibusi Sangomo is the organization's communications coordinator for Southern Africa.
We looked at democracy this time around, and we found that South Africans have actually grown more dissatisfied with the state of the country's democracy in general. The outright support for democracy has actually declined from 2011. And a majority of citizens are actually saying that they'd be willing to give up elections in favor of a non-elected government that would provide basic services.
Besides being dissatisfied with how democracy has been implemented, Ngomo says they're not very happy with their leaders either.
People are basically disappointed and disapprove across the board, from the president down to local councillors and members of parliament.
One of the recent scandals involves President Jacob Zuma spending $20 million for upgrades at one of his residences. The Afrobarometer official quotes former U.S. President Bill Clinton, who defined the main issue in his campaign by saying, "It's the economy, stupid."
That's where the issue is, and the economy is not being doing well. The service levels that people have been receiving, remember we had an electricity crisis for some time last year and the year before that. So those things are having an impact because people in South Africa are associating and have always associated to a certain extent that democracy will bring good things for the people in the country, including services.
For example, he says, someone living in a shack in a township, long without electricity or running water, may wonder how important his or her vote is.
Those things will tell me, well, maybe the system is not working. Because I go and vote every 5 years, but what has changed? Well, there has been change, but I don't think it's gone far enough. But also, people are now looking at the quality of service that they receive. So, for instance, somebody can have access to water, but they might have to share a tap with 10 other people.
The Afrobarometer survey also shows fewer people are going to vote on election days. Ngomo says opinions on democracy in South Africa varied among demographic groups.
The support for it is higher on average amongst people who are actually better educated, who are rural, who are younger and black. When we look at alternatives to democracy, for instance, South Africans in general will tell you they don't want one man rule, they don't want a return to apartheid, one party rule or military rule. But the most interesting finding we got was that 44% of white South Africans reject a hypothetical return to apartheid, but 30% would support such an initiative, and another 26% are ambivalent, or they say they don't know.
The survey shows only 49% of white South Africans support democracy. Ngomo calls those findings worrying. The figure is higher among those who are mixed race, 57%. Some 56% of Indian and South Asians in the country support democracy. Percentages are much higher among black South Africans. When asked about migrants and asylum seekers, whites and the opposition Democratic Alliance Party were more likely to block their entry into the country. Ruling ANC party supporters favored it. However, support for the ANC itself has declined among Indians and mixed-race voters. The Afrobarometer communications coordinator says the survey results could reflect growing pains in a still young democracy. But he says people are expressing themselves, and that's a good thing for democracy. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations reports 1.25 million people die in road crashes every year. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva. The United Nations says its road safety measures could save millions of lives.
The UN Economic Commission for Europe reports road crashes are the number one cause of death among people aged 15 to 29. The ECE, which regulates and sets road and vehicle safety standards, says another 20 to 50 million people worldwide are injured in these accidents. It says 90% of the 1.25 million road deaths worldwide occur in low and middle-income countries, although they account for only 54% of the world's vehicles. It notes Africa has the highest fatality rate, representing 43% of road traffic victims. UNECE Executive Secretary Christian Fries Bach says these deaths and injuries result in tremendous loss for grieving families and severe economic costs for society. He says societies have to pay the health costs of people who are badly injured and can no longer work and be productive. He says ways to avoid road crashes are known, and the auto industry knows how to produce safe cars, which are universally sold in Europe, North America, and other developed countries.
But when they sell the same car in Africa and Latin America, they take out the safety features. They take out the airbags, they weaken the frame, they produce cheap cars that look exactly like the cars we see on the roads in Europe, but when people crash, they get killed.
Bach says manufacturers can implement key safety measures in their vehicles without significant cost. He says a package of measures that can save lives, including airbags, autonomous braking systems, and seatbelts, would cost less than $200 per car. ECE Chief Bach notes too many pedestrians in Africa lose their lives because roads do not have simple safety measures such as proper crossing points. He notes the World Bank, the African Development Bank, and other development institutions and agencies that pay the cost of infrastructure in Africa should insist road safety measures be implemented. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America. Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A UN official says there's no evidence that either side in Burundi is operating in a refugee camp in Tanzania. In Kenya, six elephants have died in 1 week under unclear circumstances, and a new survey shows discontent over South Africa's state of democracy. Coming up, we'll have music from Gabon, and in our feature segment, a film that retraces Zimbabwe's War of Liberation. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Spuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand African football tops your sports report today.
Kim, joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, let's give a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the Leopards from the Democratic Republic of Congo. They lifted their second African Nations Championship trophy in Kigali, Rwanda. How about recapping their achievement for our VOA football fans?
Certainly, Sonny, and they did it in real style, a 3-0 victory in the final. The man of the match was Meshack Elia, 19 years of age. He plays for a club called Cercle Sportif Don Bosco. They're based in Lubumbashi, but they're very much overshadowed by another club from Lubumbashi, the African champions, TP Mazembe. Now, after scoring 2 goals in the group stage, Elia really set the final alight. He scored a superb first goal after 29 minutes as rain lashed down on the Amahoro Stadium in Kigali. He then scored what really was the crucial goal after 62 minutes. Nice through ball, rounded the goalkeeper and slotted the ball home. And at 2-0, you couldn't really see Mali coming back. I think Mali had sort of run their race. They had done very well just to get to the final. And then Bolingi, he scored after 73 minutes. But a very impressive performance indeed by the Democratic Republic of Congo. Just to rewind quickly, Sonny, they started with a 3-0 victory over Ethiopia. They then beat Angola 4-2. They lost their third match 3-1 to Cameroon, but there was a good reason for that. Because of the fear of suspensions and players being ruled out of the quarterfinals, the Congolese gambled by leaving out 9 of their first-choice players. On to the quarterfinals, and in many ways, this perhaps was the real final. They played a host nation, Rwanda, in Kigali, and after extra time, the Congolese emerged 2-1 victors. Another very close affair in the semifinals. Congo won, Guinea won. Guinea scoring in extra time right at the death to get that 1-1 draw, but DR Congo emerging victorious 5-4 on penalties. And talking of semifinals, my wishes for DR Congo Ivory Coast final, my predictions, spoiled Sonny right at the death again. In the 89th minute, the Suma scored for Mali, an upset 1-0 victory over Ivory Coast. And then in the match for third place, Guinea missed not one but 2 penalties, both saved by the Ivorian goalkeeper Cisse, and the Ivorians went on to win by 2-1. Some statistics, Sonny, from what was undoubtedly the best CHAN tournament yet, a big high five to the Rwandans' superb organization. And already the talk that we've had several times on the Voice of America saying that Rwanda should bid for the 225 Cup of Nations. That's the first one that's sort of available. The Rwandan officials themselves are now saying, yes, we're really interested. And if we can get government backing, we're going to go for it. And if they do go for it, Sonny, I'm convinced that CAF will give them the 225 Cup of Nations. Those leading goal scorers, Elia was one of them on 4, and the others were Akachi of Tunisia and Chikatara of Nigeria. And what you do, Sonny, in these situations now, it's CAF following the precedent set by FIFA, is that you then go to assists, in other words, the assistance in scoring of other goals, and 2 assists for Elia, and that gave him the leading scorer. He also won the player of the tournament. And he also, naturally enough, finished among the 11 players in the Dream Team from CHAN. And if we look at that team, the goalkeeper was Matapi from DR Congo. The defenders were Dante of Mali, Kimwaki of DR Congo, Kamara of Ivory Coast, and Yula of Guinea. We also had four midfielders, the very impressive Sankon of Guinea, Elia, naturally enough, from DR Congo, Nguessan of Ivory Coast, and Sinayoko of Mali. And the two strikers chosen were Bolingi of DR Congo and Koita of Mali. The fair play trophy went to DR Congo, and the gold of the tournament, which was precisely the one I had chosen, that went to Nguessan, the captain of Ivory Coast. He scored from the center circle in a quarterfinal victory over Cameroon. A truly amazing goal. And just to stir up some debate among all our listeners, Sonny, the goal I judged as being the second best was scored by Nicolas Mumi, a superb volley. He scored for Cameroon against DR Congo in the group stage. And my choice for the third best goal would be the first goal in the final from Meshek Elia. Any of our listeners who've got other suggestions, who agree with us or disagree with us, they can email myself or Sonny, and we'll be happy to share those views on air.
David, let me share our email addresses now for our Voice of America listeners. It's david.legg@afp.com. Once again, david.legg@afp.com. Leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E. And you can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Once again, sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. We're joined in the studio now by Andrew Palcheski, VOA social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny.
Andrew, what's trending in the sports world these days on social media?
Well, the Leopards, as we just heard, won the African Nations Championship, so they're trending, but not because of what they've done on the soccer field.
Okay.
They were, in fact, trending because of that. Everyone was very thrilled that they won. But the big story on social media now is that each player on the team received a brand new car for winning this tournament from the president. A $60,000 Toyota Prado.
Okay, what kind of vehicle is that?
It's a sport utility vehicle. It's a luxury vehicle. It's apparently sold under the Lexus GX brand here in the U.S. and other parts of the world. But social media has kind of run with this. So we're seeing a lot of comments, and it's interesting. A lot of the comments are saying, hard work, big reward, football pays. Someone said, hashtag motivation. My favorite, somebody just said, like a boss.
So
that
like
was
that
was my favorite.
Like a boss.
And then we're seeing pictures, too, now of all these cars lined up there. You know, dozens of them just lined up, photos of that making the rounds on social media. So a lot of people very proud and saying they deserve this award. Some people may be a little envious of their new cars.
So every player got one of those vehicles?
Every player and the bench team as well, they said. So they all are getting that from the president of the country.
So they'll be driving around in style.
Exactly, exactly. But then there's also the naysayers, whether they're envious or they raise some legitimate points, some debate over that. But people are saying the president's trying to buy support and trying to have some, good PR out of this.
So maybe there's some political overtones.
There are always political overtones. Anytime politics gets involved in social media and people wondering where the money came to do this, $60,000 a car, and there have to have been, like I said, dozens
of cars. I'm sure there's probably some tweets saying maybe it could have been directed towards
elsewhere,
health, or whatever.
Maybe instead of some flashy cards, maybe something for the country other than this big symbol of success.
Interesting. What else is trending, Andrew?
Well, the Zika virus is trending because it's taken hold in Brazil. And, of course, Rio is about to host the Summer Olympics upcoming in just a few short months. And recently, Hope Solo, who was a goalie on the U.S. Women's National Team World Cup team.
Very good player.
Excellent player, well-known, very well-known in the U.S. and around the world. She's come out and said that she wouldn't compete in Rio. If she was still on the team, she wouldn't necessarily go to this Olympics for fear of this Zika virus.
Interesting.
So
wow.
A lot of people talking about that on social media, a lot of back and forth on what this virus means for sports. Something I just saw today is that Kenya said that they may pull out of the Olympics if the virus reaches epidemic levels. And there's a lot of back and forth on social media about that. will they pull out of the Olympics? Will they not? There's some people saying, oh, they're definitely going to pull out. Some people saying, no, they've guaranteed that they won't. So a lot of back and forth on that, and that could potentially affect one of the biggest competitors at the Summer Games.
Now, you mentioned Hope Solo. Do you get the sense on Twitter that other athletes support her position, that they really have a lot of fear about this Zika virus?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of questions, especially among female athletes. There's not a lot of information about how long the Zika virus may affect them. You know, some of these athletes may not be having children in the near term, but maybe a couple years down the road, and they don't want to potentially be infected with this virus and pass it on to their children, if not in the next couple months, in the next couple years. But there seems to be general support for Hope Solo, support for more information, certainly. One of the other tweets that I saw was from the German chief Olympic doctor saying that there's no threat, no concern. So it's kind of this back and forth of information on whether the virus could have an impact or whether it's nothing to be concerned about.
And on the tweet front, Andrew, let me quickly say you can send me tweets at VOA Sunny Sports. Once again, at VOA Sunny Sports, if you want to tweet me what's on your mind about a sporty topic. I know the Super Bowl is a few days old now, Andrew. The Carolina Panthers lost to the Denver Broncos 24-10. Is the Super Bowl still trending on social media?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've seen a bunch of pictures from the parade that the Denver Broncos had in downtown Denver. So those kind of photos, videos are being shared on social media now. And there's a bit of a controversy with quarterback Cam Newton for the Carolina Panthers refusing to answer questions in the post-game press conference, saying he was a sore loser. Mm. A lot of people saying that's not how he should necessarily conduct himself as a leader of the team. So there's a lot of back and forth about that. There's a lot of Monday morning, Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning quarterbacking as it stretches on. And my favorite thing as a baseball fan is that immediately after the Super Bowl was over, Major League Baseball sent out on their social media and said, don't worry, we're just around the corner. It's only a month away until pitchers and catchers report and the baseball season kicks off. So
spring training, right?
Spring training is around the corner. So even for sports fans that are going through withdrawal because of the Super Bowl, they have something to look forward to.
Now, a lot of fans might have tuned in for the Super Bowl, not so much for the football, but maybe for the halftime show. Beyonce, Coldplay, Bruno Mars, did that get a lot of social media trending?
You know, I think at certain points that was more of a trending topic than even the game itself, because it wasn't a very well-played game by a lot of people's commentary. But it depends on who you're a fan of. If you liked Coldplay, you thought they did great, and Beyonce and Bruno Mars were okay. If you were a Beyonce fan, you thought she did great. So it depended on who you were a fan of, but a lot of conversation about that.
Now, finally, Andrew, I'll put you on the spot. A few of my colleagues said that show would have come off better if it was at nighttime rather than daylight in Santa Clara, California, that maybe it would have shown some of the sparkles a little better.
It's funny you mentioned that, because that was the first thing that we said, my friends and I, as we were watching when they started setting up the stage. We said, oh man, this light should be dark out, because some of the most iconic Super Bowl performances have come at night. Prince in the rain playing Purple Rain.
That's right. That was a great performance.
So maybe it took a little bit away from it, but it was a good show overall.
Andrew Palcheski, VOA social media reporter. We're going to hear more from Andrew in the days to come. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
Thank you.
I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the challenges firefighters face in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. And next, a film that retraces Zimbabwe's war of liberation. But first, some music. Here is Oliver Ngoma from Gabon with Ikoli. Gabon's Oliver Ngoma with Ikoli.
In Sierra Leone, fighting fires is both risky and particularly challenging due to a lack of equipment and often a lack of water. There's only two fire hydrants that work in the capital, Freetown. Firefighters lack all the basics for their job, including safety gear, and they have to pay their own medical bills if they are hurt on the job. As Africa urbanizes, cities are struggling to provide key services. Nina DeVries talks with firefighters in the country's capital, Freetown, about the challenges they face.
Abdullahi Ibrahim Karoma suffered a head injury while fighting a fire over the Christmas holiday. Karoma says he ended up paying for some of his treatment because Sierra Leone firefighters have minimal insurance coverage.
Those medication they give us now is just a first aid treatment. They are not for us to recover our health unless we use it out of our own money.
His story is typical among Sierra Leone's firefighting corps. Firefighters also lack basic gear such as breathing equipment, and there are limited helmets and boots. Alhaji Sacco is an American firefighter originally from Sierra Leone. Sacco, who visited a fire station in his homeland last month, donated more than $50,000 worth of gear, including helmets and coats. He says more is needed to help his fellow firefighters.
It's passion. I have to do something, you know, at heart, that's what I want to do. I want to give back to home.
The capital, Freetown, has only two operating fire hydrants, and neither of them is near the fire station, says the deputy chief, Sylvester Mataluva. He says it can take more than 30 minutes to get to a hydrant in heavy traffic. He says when they get to the hydrant, there's another concern.
We have problem with water for fighting fire. Normally, not all the hydrants have water.
The entire country has struggled with a water shortage for decades. The Gouma Dam, the main source of water in Freetown, was built decades ago when the city only had a population of a few thousand people. Today, the city has a population of 1.2 million, and demand has far outstripped the water supply. The government says it's trying to address the issue firefighters are facing. Joseph Bandabla Dauda is Sierra Leone's Minister of Internal Affairs. He says five new fire trucks will be coming soon from China. Others were recently donated from Germany. Dauda says firefighters are now being asked to let the water companies know when there is a fire.
As and when they are promptly informed about an area where fire incidents are so called, then they can divert the water supply to that area and make the hydrant there operational.
The hydrant would be closed again once the fire is out. He adds water companies also have bowsers, big mobile water tanks that they can bring to fires until a better solution is found. As for insurance, Dauda also admits that needs to be improved, but says the government has not received any complaints about firefighters paying their own bills from the recent fires and injuries. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
For many Zimbabweans, realizing a childhood ambition remains a pipe dream. But for Zimbabwean actor and film producer Nick Zamura, a move to the United States 15 years ago opened up many doors to his childhood passion. Today, the Sakay Teachers College trainee is a proud director of Mira Zova, an arts company he set up with his younger brother. Zamura finished filming Muwana Wamawari, a movie based on the rights of a girl child. Reporter Jonga Kandimiri caught up with Zamura in the United States, where he's currently working on a film that retraces Zimbabwe's war of liberation.
I'm a film and television producer based here in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. I produce films here and in Zimbabwe particularly. I just returned from a trip where we made two films, Makunungunu Maoza Moyo, adapted from a book by Charles Mungoshi, and Mwanawa Mwari, which was a project that I wrote as a form to platform to educate girls and people about girl child rights.
You live here in America, but you do most of your work back home.
I have a family here, so I have to come back here and be with the family, but I do love my country very much. And I try to do as much as I can. I'm very much involved in everything that is happening within the industry. I write and produce from here, and I go to Zimbabwe to do the actual filmmaking. I also do produce films here in Washington, D.C., in New York, and in Atlanta mostly. But I do enjoy working with my people in Zimbabwe, and it's something that I really wish I could do a lot more.
What inspired you to enter the film industry?
It's a thing that I started when I was a really young boy. I always knew this is what I wanted to do even before I went to college. And I think it is the idea that when you can tell a story, it has so many things that it can do to the person you are telling the story to. It can inspire, it can educate, it can motivate. And these are some of the things that I wanted to do. So I always say to people, I never quit teaching. I just change the way that I teach. It's a different medium to communicate with the same people that I've always wanted to communicate with. And it's an art form that is very interesting. You know, you're putting so many pieces together, and at the end, you come up with one thing that is very impressive, and that is very fulfilling.
Some Zimbabweans who are based in the diaspora complain that they are frustrated by the political and socioeconomic situation back home. Is this affecting you in any way?
Not particularly. Yes, things are difficult in the sense that we do not have resources. We do not have access to some of the things that we want. It takes a lot for you to be allowed to use, say, a police uniform or a military uniform to tell a story, even if it is a story in good light. We are not at a position where we can just say, you know, I want to say this about this subject, and you can say it easily. But I have not had any problems in everything that I have done. I've had the support. I've gotten letters from the police, from the National Arts Council, from the organizations that support arts and films. And what I would want to say is, let these people go and try to do it. And then they will see that some of these things are assumed and they're all imagined. They're not actually on the ground. We were in Murewa recently and they opened up everything that we wanted to use, and we managed to make our film without any problems. But we do need resources, and I may even ask those in the diaspora to say, support the causes that you believe in. Put the money where your mouth is, you know, so you can help this industry to grow, and then we can have something that we are all proud of.
We saw some prominent actors like Elijah Madzikatire, Jesus Mungoshi. How did you manage to bring them aboard?
Well, with Miss Chesses Mungoshi, it was actually her brainchild. We did her husband's book, Makunungunu Mawaza Moyo. So it was something that she had always wanted to do, and she was very heavily invested, and it was a great joy to work with her. And Elijah and I have done one movie before, and he was always somebody that I looked up to when I was growing up. And, you know, anybody who grew up loving Mkadota would be honored to work with his son. So these people are very supportive. They are very approachable, and I managed to talk to them, and we are doing these projects, and we are going to be doing more projects as well in the future.
Zimbabwean film producer and actor Nick Zemora speaking with reporter Jonga Kandemira in the U.S. state of Maryland. This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdulrahman, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria James Entwistle was present at the Memorandum of Understanding signing ceremony in Kaduna, Nigeria in late January for routine immunization in Borno, Kaduna, Sokoto, and Bauchi states. I am proud that the U.S. government is joining the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Dangote Foundation in the strong pursuit to end vaccine-preventable child deaths in Nigeria, said Ambassador Entwistle. Under this partnership, we are helping Sokoto State to increase and sustain high immunization coverage. This occasion demonstrates the willingness and commitment of your governments and organizations to tackle the challenges to achieving these goals. The United States provides significant resources, more than $500 million annually, for programs to address serious health issues, such as child mortality, maternal and newborn health, HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. These MOUs offer the model platform to capitalize on the prospects of evidence-based approaches, said Ambassador Entwistle. Results will include stronger systems for immunizations, equal access to routine immunization services, and building capacity for Nigerian states like Sokoto to lead in developing solutions for its people. Perhaps even more importantly, these agreements serve as a model on which to base future partnerships between development partners and the government of Nigeria. Ensuring transparency and accountability in the implementation of this program demonstrates the pledge of the governments of all the states involved to ensuring they meet their responsibilities to their constituents. Essential health services, like routine immunization programs, can only be provided when all partners are coordinated and committed in this manner. Immunization represents one of the most cost-effective public health interventions. Routine immunization services, when sustained, reduce maternal and child illnesses and deaths and free up other resources for economic development. Under this partnership, the U.S. government will maintain its focus on Sokoto State, offering quality technical assistance in support of the partners' harmonized work plan in that state. Our ultimate goal, said Ambassador Entwistle, is to end preventable child and maternal deaths and to achieve an AIDS-free generation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.